She picks at a plate of cold tostones, the sole remnants from last night's dinner still waiting in the fridge when she got home. Dad must have taken the rest with him to Jenkins. She thinks about microwaving the leftover plantains, but she's too hungry to wait. She reaches for the salt. She had wanted to go to Brooklyn, to visit Anna in person, but the center's visitation policy is inflexible. Only immediate family, and further, only adults. Martina is neither. Boxed out. Not that Mommy would have let her go anyway. She doesn't approve of the podcast, would certainly never approve of her daughter visiting a criminal in a detention center. But Martina would have gone anyway, if Pathways had let her. Martina is 17, newly a senior at Jefferson. She'll be applying to colleges soon, moving away, hopefully to the city to double major in journalism and sociology at NYU. She's almost an adult. What Mommy doesn't know won't kill her. Martina cringes inwardly and thanks her lucky stars she didn't say that out loud, in hearing distance of the neighbors. It has been a full month now since Anna's arrest. The revelation that Zoe is really dead has barely settled in for Martina, for anyone, even though her body, or what was left of it, has been found. Even though her family confirmed her identity and the dental records sealed the deal. The family can't have a funeral yet. Not if they want a body to bury. The autopsy results still haven't come in. It's not like on TV. Postmortems moving lightning fast. Cases being closed by the end of the 60-minute episode. It still seems impossible to believe they found her in Catherine Hunt's missing motorboat, albeit at the bottom of nearby Parrish Lake, not submerged in the Atlantic Ocean. Martina was wrong about the boat, but not about the most important thing. Zoe wasn't trying to run away. Someone put Zoe's body in that boat. Someone sank it to the bottom of the lake. Someone who might be Anna. Martina knows that she confessed, understands that things don't look great for the girl she'd only just gotten to know this past summer. But just like with the police's bogus theories about Zoe the runaway, there are lots of things that don't add up for Martina about Anna's confession. Officially, the details won't be made public until the case goes to trial. But everyone seems to know what Anna told police. Secrets don't stay secret for long in Heron Mills, and Anna's friend Kaylee spread this one like wildfire. She told anyone who would listen exactly how wrong Anna's story is, but hearing Kaylee say it just made everyone believe. How Anna got Zoe drunk before she fell from the Windermere balcony that night. How Anna drove her body to the lake, hid it in the boat. Martina pops another piece of plantain in her mouth. Martina Jenkins? She swallows quickly. Yes, speaking. You have 10 minutes with Miss Ciccone, understood? Martina hears a soft scuffling sound on the other end of the line. Then Anna's voice breaks through. Martina? Hey, okay if I record this? There's a momentary pause. Sure. Everything's recorded on this end anyway. I'm sorry I didn't call sooner. I was angry at first and really sad. And then there was like a 3-step approval process just to get a phone call. Yeah, they love their approval processes around here. Anna makes a sound that's almost a laugh, but not quite. I wanted you to know I'm working on another episode of the podcast. Oh, what for? Martina takes in a deep breath, gets ready to say the words she's been rehearsing since school let out. I think there are still a lot of unanswered questions about that night. I'm not sure you could have done what you said you did. Or maybe I'm just not understanding, and I want to understand. I'd like to speak with you, Anna. Again.
Like an interview?
Exactly. I'd schedule it through Pathways, just like this. Would you be open to that? Martina is very aware of the formality of her words, all the ease she'd begun to feel with Anna over the summer, the beginning of what felt like a real friendship, is buried beneath the weight of what happened to Zoe, the place where Anna is locked up, the circumstances surrounding this phone call.
I think I would, Anna says finally. I think I'm starting to have some questions too, about that night.
We both want the same thing, Martina says carefully. Just to know what happened, to get some real answers for Aster and her parents.
Most of all, even more than she wants to uncover something important, something that will get her into NYU in spite of her miserable track record with standardized tests. And she wants NYU a lot.
Martina wants answers for her best friend. The real answers.
She watched the discovery of Zoe's body steal the last flash of hope from Aster's eyes. She saw her best friend crumble. Martina can't get Zoe back for Aster. No one can. But she's going to try her hardest to bring Aster a little bit of peace. Answers, solid, definitive, let you sleep at night.
Will you help me? She asks.
Yeah, Anna says. Yes. Martina exhales. Then Anna's voice drops.
Can I ask you one thing?
Sure.
Has Caden said anything about me?
Martina chews on the inside of her cheek. Growing up, she used to feel a tenuous kind of connection to Caden, even though he was 3 years ahead of her in school. When you live in a town as white as Heron Mills, you notice the one or two, in her case, two, other biracial kids at your school. Maybe you aren't close friends, but you exchange glances, keep tabs. But Caden has been less than cooperative over the past 6 months. Any connection she used to feel is gone.
He's back at Yale, she says finally. I haven't seen him.
Right, Anna says quickly, of course.
I'll schedule the call,
Martina confirms, and the girls say their goodbyes. Alone again in her kitchen, Martina punches the phone's red end call button. Anna should be in college herself by now. Martina wonders if she'll still get to go sometime, or if she'll end up getting her degree in prison. She eyes the remaining tostones and decides she's not really hungry anymore. She'd rather think about college than the question of if Anna really did it. But of course, that's exactly what she needs to figure out. For Aster and Zoe. For the whole Spanos family. For herself. Because once again, the police have latched onto the available explanation. They have their suspect, their confession, their easy answer. Even though Martina can spot at least three gaping holes in what she's heard of Anna's story. Holes she's sure the police have decided to conveniently ignore in the interest of closing the case. Martina has seen every true crime documentary available on Netflix and Investigation Discovery, has listened to enough episodes of The Vanished and Criminal and True Crime Garage to develop a healthy distrust of law enforcement. She's watched footage of detectives cajoling confessions out of minors without their parents in the room. She's listened to heartbreaking testimonies from the wrongfully convicted and stories of police departments and sheriff's departments bungling investigations due to lack of resources or lack of communication or lack of expertise or the plain willful conviction that they've got their man. At the same time, Martina's gut says that Anna is lying. Maybe she's innocent. Or maybe whatever happened that night was much worse than the story she told police. She wants to trust Anna. But Anna never told Martina about the messages from Zoe on her phone. What else has Anna been hiding? Maybe her confession doesn't add up because Anna is manipulating the details. In the grand scheme of things, a charge of second-degree manslaughter looks a lot better than murder. Martina makes the same silent promise she made back when she recorded the first episode of Missing Zoe last February. She's going to do her best to find out what happened to her best friend's sister. She's going to put her interests in journalism and true crime reporting to work to get answers to the questions the detectives should be asking. If Anna is innocent, she's going to use what small platform she has to try to ensure justice isn't falsely served. But if she's guilty, she's going to root out the truth for the Spanos family, uncover the real story beneath Anna's murky confession.
Chapter 8. Then, June, Heron Mills, New York. It's raining. A hard, drenching cascade that seems to barrel from the clouds in fully formed sheets. It pummels the Clovelly cottage roof, the grounds, goads the pool's infinity edge into a gushing waterfall. It's only 10:30, and Paisley is bored with Quiddler and Ticket to Ride. I suggest Moana, then Happy Feet, then Matilda. Paisley is not in the mood. Paisley wants to do something. It's clearly not a beach day, and unlikely to clear up into a town day anytime soon. I can hear Amelia in her office on what sounds like an intense phone call about deliverables and reliable vendors for high-end printed something or other. I'm on my own to figure out a fun indoor activity. I promise Paisley that if she puts the board games away, I'll have a surprise plan for the morning by the time she's done. She gives me a look like she sees right through me, but agrees with a dainty handshake. I slink out of the family room, totally unsure how I'm going to deliver on my promise. I try to remember what my mom did with me when I was Paisley's age. Mostly, she sent me out to run around with the neighborhood kids or parked me in front of the TV. She worked a lot. We definitely couldn't afford a nanny. But sometimes we baked together. On weekend mornings, we'd mix up batter for pancakes or banana bread or mini blueberry muffins. Over the holidays, she'd break out the Pizzelle iron, and we'd bake batch after batch of the thin Italian waffle cookies that both my parents were raised on. I put my money on Paisley's sweet tooth and wander into the Bellamy's immaculate, navy-ceilinged kitchen, hoping their cook, Mary, won't mind too much if we make a mess before she gets in to start the dinner prep at 3. It doesn't take long to find the basics. Flour, sugar, butter, eggs, milk. There's a revolving tray of every spice imaginable nestled in one tall cabinet, along with cocoa powder, semi-sweet chips, baking powder, vanilla, and a host of other ingredients. We're in business. I'm resting my arms on the counter, scrolling through recipe options on my phone when Paisley comes in. Found you. She surveys the ingredients surrounding my elbows. Cookies? She asks, face lighting up. I breathe an inward sigh of relief. Or brownies, maybe. I'm looking at recipes now. Let's make peanut butter and jelly cookies, Paisley says. I'm typing her request into the search box when Paisley points to a beautiful cream stone box resting at the back of the counter, beside a built-in butcher block. It's in the recipe box. Ah. I set my phone down and lift the lid, which is heavy and cool to the touch. I didn't realize people kept real recipe boxes anymore, but based on the cramped scrawl and yellowed edges surrounding most of the index cards, I'd be willing to guess these have been passed down from a previous generation. Inside, everything is organized neatly by category. Fish, poultry, appetizers, etc. I flip through to dessert. The recipe for peanut butter and jelly cookies is right up front. Unlike its fellows, this card is pink, and the recipe itself has been typed out and pasted on. There's an oily smudge in the top left corner, probably dried peanut butter. Paisley expertly locates the stand mixer and remaining ingredients. I preheat the oven and we get to work. The batter is easy, just eggs, sugar, peanut butter, and vanilla. Paisley presses her thumb into the center of each cookie to make a small impression, which we fill with apricot or strawberry or raspberry jam from an assortment of little pots in the fridge. By lunchtime, we have 3 batches cooling, a 4th in the oven, and 2 more ready to go. We may have gone a bit overboard, but I'm sure Paisley has friends who'd be willing to take some fresh-baked cookies off our hands. I task Paisley with returning cold ingredients to the fridge, then begin loading dishes in the dishwasher. The rain has abated to a dull gray drizzle, and if the sun ever comes out, we can spend the afternoon making deliveries around the neighborhood. Installed on the patio beneath the overhang, munching cookies and the shrimp and watercress sandwiches Mary has left us for lunch, Paisley and I make our game plan for the afternoon. She knows exactly which families are likely to be home, within walking distance, and free from peanut allergies. I guess that's common knowledge among elementary schoolers. As we stand to take our plates inside, the first few tentative rays of sunlight filter down to the glistening surfaces of the lawn and pool. The air is heavy with moisture, but the clouds above are white and rapidly clearing. The rain is done. The only paper plates I can find in the kitchen are the fancy kind, decorated with a floral pattern and thin gold band around the rim. I'm a little hesitant to open the package, but Amelia's office door is still firmly shut, and worst case scenario, I'll replace them. I leave a note for Amelia on the kitchen table, along with a couple dozen cookies. As I'm plating the rest and covering them with plastic wrap, Paisley wanders away from the table and reaches across the stovetop to fiddle with the buttons. I whip around. "What you doing, Paisley?" She turns, looking guiltily. "It got left on," she says. "I didn't want you to get in trouble." "Oh." My shoulders slump. I leave the cookies and walk over to Paisley, squatting down in front of her. "Hey, I'm sorry. That was my bad, not yours. Next time, just tell me if I screw something up, okay?" She nods. "Deal." I give her shoulder a squeeze, then press the oven's off button firmly with my thumb. I tell myself it's not a big deal. It's not like the house was going to burn down while we went out for a couple hours. But if Amelia had noticed, or Mary, they might not agree. My stomach churns, and I have to force my eyes away from the well-stocked liquor cabinet above my head. 5 minutes later, the plates of cookies are stacked in a tote bag along with a couple water bottles and sunscreen, and Paisley and I are off. The air along the driveway is even stickier than it was on the patio, and by the time we reach the road, my skin is coated in a thin sheen of sweat. The clouds have mostly cleared, and the sun is out in full, blazing force, turning the petals of the rain-soaked azaleas into shiny pink mirrors as we pass. Damp tendrils of hair cling to the back of my neck, and I run my fingers along my bare wrist, searching for an elastic that isn't there. I take the sunscreen out of my bag and make Paisley stop so I can coat both our faces and arms before we continue on. Paisley has 4 stops planned on our route, the first of which is 2 houses down on Linden Lane in the same direction we walked yesterday into town. Claudia, Paisley explains to me as we buzz at their gate and wait to be let in, is less than a year older but a grade ahead due to how their birthdays fall. She used to be Paisley's best friend until last spring, when Claudia confided in her that she was getting teased for hanging out with a second grader. There's a crackling at the intercom, and we introduce ourselves. As the gates swing open, Paisley wrinkles her nose. "She's been extra nice to me since school let out. Like, when no one from her grade is around, she thinks things can just go back to normal." "Well, it's nice of you to bring her cookies. Eventually, she's going to realize that good friendships are much more important than the opinions of some girls who don't know what they're talking about." "And if she doesn't?" "And if she doesn't, it's her mistake. You deserve people in your life who are going to have your back." Paisley is still beaming up at me when the door opens to reveal a plump woman with frosted, spiky blonde hair. She's dressed in all black save for a giant red statement necklace, and her eyes are heavily made up with black liner and mascara. She looks like she belongs in the West Village, not the Hamptons. Paisley! She exclaims, while I twist my hair behind me and tuck it down the back of my tank top in an effort to minimize what I'm starting to think of as the Zoe factor. I keep my sunglasses on. Hi, Mrs. Cooper. Paisley turns her smile toward the woman, who is presumably Claudia's mom. I'm Anna, I say, extending my hand. Paisley's nanny. Mercifully, there's no shock of recognition on the older woman's face, no hand reaching to scrub across her eyes, no awkward double take. She takes my hand in hers, and I notice her nails are painted the same deep red as her necklace. Mrs. Cooper graciously accepts Paisley's offering of cookies, explaining that Claudia will be at a riding lesson until 4. We're still on for tomorrow afternoon? She asks. I stare blankly. The girls have a pool date, she says after a minute. Just drop Paisley off at 2. I thought Amelia might have mentioned it. Paisley nods and gives my hand a tug. We talked about it at breakfast, she reminds me. Oh, of course, I murmur. We did? We're on, I say with a smile. I need to get my head together. The rest of our route takes us off Linden Lane and away from Main Street, deeper into residential Heron Mills. 2 of the 3 families are home, and we spend an hour or so at the Paulson Gosses, Paisley and Rachel running around upstairs in a house that I'm relieved to see more closely resembles a regular suburban dwelling, while Elizabeth and I chat about my college plans. Yes, I'll be living in the dorms. No, I haven't yet picked out a major, over sweating glasses of iced green tea in the kitchen. When I catch Elizabeth glancing at the microwave clock, I call for Paisley upstairs and explain we still have another stop or two to make, even though this was the end of the line. Outside, Paisley and I make our way quickly back to Clovelly Cottage. We're both hot and sweaty, and the oven's temperature display flashes across my eyelids every time I blink. So careless. We'll take a dip in the infinity pool, wash the afternoon off our skin. By 4:30, we're both showered and changed for dinner, towels and swimsuits drying on the pool deck. I duck into the kitchen for some baby carrots and hummus and find Mary, a tall, plump woman in a tailored white chef's jacket with black buttons, hard at work on something that smells like garlic and white wine. My mouth waters. Dinner's at 6:30, she reminds me, and I promise we won't fill up on snacks. She glances at the heaping plate of cookies still sitting on the kitchen table. I see Paisley introduced you to her favorites. We may have gone a bit overboard, I admit. Please help yourself. I remember the 4th paper plate still sitting in my tote in the entryway, and suddenly I get an idea. Hey, Paisley! I slip out of the kitchen and into the family room, where Paisley is dressed in a matching white cotton short and top set on the couch, watching some kid's show I don't recognize. I place the hummus and carrots on the coffee table in front of her. Want to take that last plate of cookies next door? She wrinkles her nose at me. The Andersons are in Lucerne until August, she says. The other next door, the Talbots. Beneath her summer tan, the color drains out of Paisley's face. To Windermere? She asks, voice suddenly soft and filled with breath. She shakes her head back and forth, almost violently, fine blonde hair whipping in still wet ropes against the back of the couch. I frown. I'm not sure what's going on with Paisley, but I've never seen her act like this. Right, to Windermere, I say. I'm sure the Talbots like cookies. No way. Paisley draws her knees into her chin, and I can see the feathery blonde hairs prickle along her arms and legs. She lowers her voice to a whisper and looks straight into my eyes.
It's haunted.
I sit down on the couch next to her, smoothing my sundress over my knees and trying not to laugh. Windermere has clearly seen better days, and I can see why a kid might be creeped out by the overgrown vegetation hiding the house from the road. It does look a bit like something out of a gothic fairy tale. It's not haunted, I assure her. It just needs a little TLC, and Caden seems really nice. Paisley nods, her chin bobbing against her knees, still clutched against her chest. Yeah, Caden's nice, she agrees, but I'm not going over there. She turns back to face the TV screen, and I can see I've lost her. I glance at Amelia's office door, still closed. She might not approve, but running out for a few minutes seems like it would be okay. Mary's here, after all. I poke my head into the kitchen to ask if she can keep an eye on Paisley for a little while. Cookies retrieved from my tote, I set off again down the drive toward the road, then hang a left, back toward Windermere. At the gate, it takes me a minute to locate a buzzer through the crawling vines. When I do find a small cream button nestled into a flat panel on one of the stone pillars, it looks more like a regular doorbell than the sophisticated intercom boxes installed at the entrances to Clovelly Cottage and the other houses on our route today. I press my finger against it, and a dull light glows beneath the plastic, instilling in me a dubious confidence that somewhere inside the house a chime is ringing. I wait for a minute that becomes three. Up the drive, I can see two cars parked near the house, an older sports car and something long, expensive-looking, and black. Someone is home. I wonder if there used to be an intercom, if the speaker is broken, if pressing the bell did anything at all. I slip my foot out of my sandal and run my big toe up and down against the back of my calf, scratching at one of the several mosquito bites that have swelled into itchy red welts, despite my best efforts with bug spray. Kaylee would laugh if she saw me now. Every summer, no matter what I do, mosquitoes flock to me and leave her completely unscathed. I picture her at the beach with Ian, the guy she's been low-key on-again, off-again with all senior year, packing up their stuff as the sun begins its slow dip toward the ocean. With a swell of guilt, I realize I still haven't called her. I resolve to pick up the phone soon, no matter what. Just as I'm debating pressing the bell again or giving up and heading back, the front door swings open and Caden steps onto the porch. As he walks toward me, I'm surprised to see he's dressed up. Gone are the jeans and plaid shirt, replaced with pressed khaki slacks, an olive button-down tucked in at the waist, and brown dress shoes. I guess they dress for dinner at Windermere, too. As he approaches the gate, I can see him squinting at me through the rails and scrolls. There's a falter in his step. He must not recognize me from the other night. "It's Anna," I call out. "Paisley's nanny." He keeps walking, then pauses on the other side of the gate, not saying anything in return. His face finally comes into focus, and something unlatches inside my chest. Caden in daylight. His features are delicate but not sharp, gentle, except for his eyebrows, which form two bold brush strokes across his forehead. Beneath them, his eyes are surprisingly hard. They narrow, taking me in, and whatever had come loose inside me before tightens again. Anna in daylight is clearly not what he'd hoped for. I can feel my cheeks burn red, and realizing he still hasn't said a word, I hold up the plate of cookies, wondering if I can slide them through the gate and run. "Paisley and I baked," I offer, cursing the tremble in my voice. Caden presses something on the other side of the pillar, and the gate creaks and slides on its track, disappearing into a slot in the stone. He motions toward the house with his chin. Come on. As we walk up the drive toward Windermere, cookies still clutched in my hands, I can feel Caden's eyes trained on my face. I make myself look anywhere but at him. To our left is the pond he mentioned restoring. The lawn around it has been freshly mowed, and there's a large pile of weeds and debris on the bank closest to the gate. My eyes skate across the lawn up to the house itself, which is still majestic in stature and has not been long enough neglected to have fallen into serious disrepair. If they would bring someone in to hack down the vines and clean up the landscaping, that would be 90% of the job, but I keep my lips pressed tightly together. Not my business. You look different without your hoodie, Caden says finally as we near the porch. He pauses, so I pause too, and I make myself turn to face him. We're both standing on the first step, suspended between the drive and the porch. Our bodies are suddenly close together. I'm in his space, but I didn't mean to be. I want to take a step back, but can't decide if that would be even more awkward. Before I can make up my mind, he reaches one hand slowly toward me and gently lifts a dark lock of hair between his fingers. Raven, he says. Above us, I hear a flutter and series of cries, and then I do take a step back, off the stairs, feet returning to the drive. Caden drops his hand and shoves it in his pocket. I look up in time to see a cloud of black feathers lift off from the third-floor balcony, 20 birds or more taking to the sky. Ravens, Caden says again, and I wonder if I misunderstood him the first time. My mother keeps birds, parakeets mostly, sometimes canaries. The wild birds can smell the feed. They're always around. There's something stiff about his voice, his posture. Not at all like the other night, his casual lean against the pillar, the easy conversation. I get the sense he's being polite, and my stomach clenches. I keep my eyes trained on the balcony, and as the ravens disperse against the sky, I'm hit with a powerful wave of vertigo. It strikes hard and fast, the balcony tilting toward me, or the driveway rippling to waves beneath my feet. I pitch forward. I'm falling. I grasp at the house with my free hand, try to steady myself as Windermere careens around me, falling, everything falling. I shut my eyes and let the wall's brown shingles take solid shape against my hand until the vertigo passes and the world rights itself again. I draw a deep breath in. You okay? Caden is squinting at me, concerned. Just dizzy for a sec. I think I looked up too fast. It sounds good, but I'm not sure what that was. I've never been great with heights, but staring up from below has never been a problem. Something about that balcony tipped the world off kilter. Caden nods, satisfied, then turns abruptly and walks up the stairs to the front door. You better come in, since you're here, he says, swinging the door wide. Immediately, I hear barking, and we're met by a mid-sized brown and white dog. Some kind of spaniel. That's Jake, Caden says, ruffling the dog's floppy ears. He's friendly. I join Caden on the porch and let Jake sniff my hand, which he promptly fills with his warm muzzle. Jake's coat is shiny and he looks well cared for, but as I crouch down to pet him, I have to hold my breath. He smells, really smells. I straighten up and take a step toward the house, and that's when it hits me that the smell isn't coming from Jake. It's coming from inside Windermere. In the entryway, the mysterious odor is immediately identifiable. The hall is absolutely teeming with birds and bird droppings. There are cages hanging here and there, others propped on various pieces of once beautiful furniture. But the doors have been unlatched, and the birds seem to have free rein of the place. My mouth must be hanging open because Caden says, "You're here all summer, right? You were going to see it sooner or later." I snap my jaw shut and try to breathe through my teeth. "My mother isn't well," he says. "I think I mentioned the other night." He gestures loosely toward a portrait of a pretty young woman with fair skin and glossy brown hair hanging at the base of a tall, gently curving staircase to my left. The banister, once a grand thing, is dusty and coated with bird shit. She was in her late 20s or early 30s when that portrait was done. The man in the painting next to her was my father. Died when I was a little kid. I don't really remember him. Both of Caden's parents appear to be white, and I wonder if he was adopted. It doesn't seem like the right time to ask. "I'm sorry," I say, "about your dad." Caden shrugs but doesn't say anything. "And that your mom is sick," I add. I feel like an intruder in their home. It was clearly beautiful once. The furnishings in the entry hall look old and sturdy and probably very expensive. A dust-covered tapestry lines one wall, and to my left, beyond the staircase, is what appears to be a formal living room or parlor. The curtains are drawn across floor-to-ceiling windows, and the room is swallowed in musty darkness. Did he invite me inside to gawk? Or is this some sort of test of my character? If it is, I'm not sure I'm passing. "I brought cookies," I say again, holding out the little plate. "We baked way too many. I hope you like peanut butter." Caden's thick eyebrows arch suddenly toward the ceiling, and he looks at the plastic-wrapped plate in my hand for the first time. Without warning, he reaches out and takes it from me, a little too sharply. "What are these?" he asks. "Peanut butter and jelly cookies?" A dark cloud passes over his face, and I feel a lump take shape in my throat. "I thought, we used 3 different kinds of jam," I start to ramble. "But if you don't like them, I'm sure we'll do more baking later." "Please take them back." Caden's voice is cold. He holds the plate out toward me, his arms stiff and eyes hard. I try to swallow, but my mouth is completely dry. "Okay, sure." I grasp the cookies, wishing I had a bag I could shove them into. I've done something horribly, irrevocably wrong, made some mysterious faux pas. Jake brushes against my legs, and I pat the top of his head, more to reassure myself than anything else.
"You should go,"
Caden says, as I'm already turning toward the door, ready to leave Windermere and never return. Maybe Paisley was right. This place is haunted, not by the dead, but by the flinty secrets of the living. I stumble down the porch steps and back to the gate, which Caden has mercifully left open as if he knew my stay inside the Windermere grounds would be brief. I turn the corner onto Linden Lane and sprint toward Clovelly Cottage, punching in the code at the end of the drive with trembling fingers. I mess it up the first time, then make myself stop a moment, take a breath. Down the road, just past Claudia Cooper's house, Tom's Lexus is parked on the street. He's standing outside, leaning against the SUV's driver's side door, and raking his fingers through his hair. I raise my hand to wave, but he doesn't see me. He's clearly involved in a very intense phone call that doesn't seem close to ending anytime soon. So I get my shit together and punch in the gate code again. Instead of going in through the front door, I duck around the side of the house and cross behind the pool, waving feebly to Mary and Paisley, who are carrying glasses and a stack of plates out to the table on the porch, then slip into my cottage. I jam the plate of cookies into the trash, then collapse on the bed, tears filling my eyes. I swipe them away, angry at myself for letting Caden get to me. He was the rude one, stormy and harsh for no good reason. I didn't do anything wrong. Did I? The clock on my phone says there's still an hour until dinner. I need to move to get this funk out of my system. I won't have time to shower again, but I don't care. I slip out of my sundress and into my one athletic outfit and sneakers, then grab my phone and earbuds and start jogging back around the house, down the drive. When I turn onto Linden Lane, the street is empty where Tom's Lexus was parked a few minutes ago. Instead of music, I pull up my podcast and hit play on the second episode of Missing Zoe.
Missing Zoe. Episode 2, The Boyfriend Theory.
They were that couple, you know?
I thought something might have happened, but I didn't want to ask. But then Zoe was with Caden at the gospel choir's winter concert right before break, and everything seemed fine. That was the last time I saw her.
Hi, listeners, and welcome back. Today, I've got the second episode of Missing Zoe for you. But if you didn't catch episode 1, you should probably start there to learn about Zoe Spanos, the young woman who vanished without a trace from her Heron Mills hometown last New Year's Eve, and why we're discussing her case here. Go ahead and listen. I'll be here when you get back. Okay, everybody ready? Today is Tuesday, February 18th, and it's been 7 weeks to the day since Zoe disappeared. Zoe Spanos is still missing, and we're missing Zoe. If you know Zoe personally, or if you've been following the media coverage of her case, you may have noticed that I left out something, or rather someone, important in last week's episode. Zoe's longtime boyfriend, Caden Talbot. And that's because I'm going to devote the majority of this episode to Caden and his relationship with Zoe. If you follow true crime media at all, or read murder mysteries or missing girl stories, or watch Law & Order or CSI, you know that the husband or boyfriend is the first person the police bring in when a woman goes missing or is the victim of a violent crime. In July 2017, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report that showed over half of women killed in the United States are victims of intimate partner violence. I spoke with Judith Corrado-Smith, Assistant Director for Communication at the CDC, over the phone from her Atlanta, Georgia office. Here's what she had to say.
Our study looked at 10,018 murders of women in 18 states from 2003 through 2014. Of those deaths, 55% were intimate partner violence related. We say intimate partner violence related because crimes committed by a family member or friend of the victim's partner are included within this classification. However, in 93% of the intimate partner murder cases we examined, the perpetrator was a current or former romantic partner of the victim. Strangers perpetrate just 16% of all the homicides where a woman is the victim. The popular narrative of a random killing by a mysterious stranger may be great fodder for urban legends and ghost stories, but it's just not a likely scenario.
While tales of stranger danger certainly haunt our cultural psyche, today's crime dramas and murder mysteries also frequently explore the narrative that the CDC's study confirmed. In real life, as in fiction, there's a very good chance that the husband/boyfriend did it. But let's take a step back. You're probably asking, does Martina Green believe that Caden Talbot was responsible for Zoe's disappearance, or that he may have even killed her? The short answer is no. I don't believe this to be true. We have no evidence that Zoe is dead, nor do I think it likely that Caden was the perpetrator of violence against her.
I can't speak to his mental state. I'm not a mental health care practitioner. But in terms of personality, Caden was never anything but a kind, conscientious member of our Jefferson community. Very bright, one of our academic superstars, especially in the humanities, although he held his own in my class, too. And he was very devoted to Zoe.
That's Miss Fox Rigg, a chemistry teacher at Jefferson High School. You'll hear more from her in our third episode.
The more complicated answer to the question of why look so hard at Caden is this. Because the police latched on so quickly to their Zoe as runaway theory, I don't believe they did their due diligence in this regard.
And this was a grave oversight, because whether or not he had anything to do directly with Zoe's disappearance, Caden is the one person in Zoe's life most likely to be in possession of valuable information in her case. Information that may seem trivial or unrelated, but which could be extremely useful to police.
Both Caden and Meredith Talbot were identified as persons of interest early in our investigation. They are not suspects. As the investigation remains open, I cannot comment further on our interactions with the Talbots.
You might remember A.D. Massey from our first episode as an officer on Zoe's case. While the detective would not delve into particulars, to the best of my knowledge, Caden Talbot and his mother, Mrs. Meredith Talbot, were each brought in for questioning only once by police following Zoe's disappearance. I tried to get Caden to speak with me for this episode, but those requests were declined. I'll keep pressing for future episodes. While police have refrained from further exploring what I'm calling the boyfriend theory, it's my belief that buried somewhere in the contours of Zoe and Caden's relationship lies the key that will unlock the mystery to what happened on New Year's Eve. Let's start at the beginning, with some background on the Talbot and Spanos families. I checked in again with village historian Alfred Harvey for a dose of family history.
The Talbots are old Heron Mills. The family has been in the area since the late 1800s, shortly after Heron Mills was incorporated as a village. They're one of the few families in the area who have been here since the beginning and still have a presence.
What can you tell us about the recent generations of Talbots?
Well, Lawrence and Fay were the fifth generation at Windermere, the family's Linden Lane estate. They were born to parents Daniel and Martha in 1968 and 1971, respectively. Daniel and Martha relocated to London in the early 90s, leaving Windermere in their son Lawrence's care. Fay lives in the Boston area with her wife Carla, and to the best of my knowledge, the two have never shown an interest in taking over management of the estate. Lawrence Talbot, known to his friends and colleagues as Larry, was a very successful art dealer until his death in 2006. Stomach cancer. He was only 38. Lawrence left Windermere to his wife Meredith and son Caden, who inhabit it today.
And the Spanos family?
There's less to tell. George and Joan Spanos are much newer to Heron Mills. They moved to our village from Queens, New York in 1995, when George established his landscape architecture practice in the East End. Joan was then an assistant editor and is now the editor-in-chief of Wayfair and Ramble, a New York City-based travel magazine. As your listeners will know, they have two daughters, Zoe and Aster.
At 3 years apart, you'd think things might have been competitive between them, but it was never really like that.
You're hearing from Harriet Benyon, a friend of Aster's and mine, from school. While I could talk all day about the Spano sisters, I wanted you to be able to hear a perspective apart from my own.
They fought sometimes. They were normal siblings. I wouldn't exactly describe them as best friends. They each had their own groups. But even though Aster was younger, she was always taking care of Zoe. I remember one of the first times I went over to their place. I think Aster and I were 11 and Zoe was 14. We were watching this movie about witches, and Aster held Zoe's hand through all the scary parts. That's a pretty good metaphor for their relationship. Her sister's disappearance has been really hard on Aster. I mean, obviously. But she feels like she let her guard down. Like she should have been there personally to stop anything bad from happening to Zoe.
George and Joan? They're typical Heron Mills parents.
Again, I wanted to bring you an outside take. So now you're hearing from Elle Coleridge, another classmate of Aster's and mine. Elle is the president of Jefferson's DECA and FBLA chapters, and she and Aster are both on swim team. Elle, can you tell us what you mean by typical Heron Mills parents?
Oh, well, you know, busy, career-focused, big ambitions for their kids. They were thrilled when Aster made captain this year. Aster's a little short for a swimmer, but she's a total powerhouse. It's usually George in the bleachers at meets. I think Joan's in the city a lot for work.
Do you get the impression they aren't around enough for their daughters?
No, I'm not saying that. I think, like most parents around here, Mr. and Mrs. Spanos are balancing demanding jobs with raising a family. It's like there are a lot of expectations placed on modern parents, especially mothers, to be everything all the time. It's just not realistic. They're good parents. Everyone's saying they dropped the ball, trying to shove responsibility off on the family? It's gross. You know, no one has ever solved the Long Island serial killer murders, and that's mostly because those girls were escorts and no one reported them missing. For years, law enforcement didn't care. It's so sad. I'm not saying LISK has anything to do with Zoe, but this is a case where her family cares deeply. I can't even look at Reddit anymore. What we need is a real lead, so people will stop passing judgment on the family, as if letting their college-aged daughter go to a New Year's party was some kind of sin.
Indeed. Let's turn now to Caden and really dig into that relationship. Zoe and Caden have known each other practically since infancy. Their friendship turned romantic in early high school, and they began dating during the summer following ninth grade. Zoe has always been much beloved by Mrs. Talbot. In turn, the Spanos family doted on Caden. At school, they were the couple everyone was rooting for, the couple everyone secretly wished they could be. And their relationship didn't just look picture perfect from the outside. As anyone who has ever been in high school knows, relationships are very much on display within school walls. Whether you've been part of a high school couple or observed others, you know what sort of microscope those relationships are under. I spoke on the phone with Di McAdam, former Jefferson senior class president, from her dorm room at Skidmore.
Zoe and Caden were... Wow. I'm still just so shocked. I'm sorry. Okay. Zoe and Caden. They were that couple, you know? And they didn't even care about being popular. They were nominated for homecoming court a couple times, but they turned that stuff down. They had friends, but they mostly kept to themselves. I think that's why everyone loved them so much. They weren't big on PDA. They didn't rub their relationship in anyone's face. But they were clearly very much in love. She was always so sweet to him. And when she talked, you could tell he really listened.
Would you consider either of them close friends?
I was closer to Caden. He was on student council all 4 years, so we spent a lot of time together planning events and sitting in student gov meetings, that sort of thing. He was really serious about Zoe. One time, I remember he asked for my opinion on a gift for her. He was picking out a necklace. He wanted to make sure it was something she would actually wear. And it was beautiful. A delicate chain with her initials in gold. Perfect. In our senior superlatives, they were voted couple most likely to actually get hitched, which tells you something, you know? The fact that they were totally rock solid through graduation and beyond is pretty unusual. I mean, how many couples do you know who make it all the way through high school? But that's just who Caden and Zoe were. They were in their own happy little orbit.
The summer before starting college, Caden and Zoe were stronger than ever. I saw Zoe a lot that summer. I was often over at the Spanos' home with Aster. Zoe was getting ready to begin her first year at Brown, and Caden was set to begin his at Yale. You might think the decision to attend separate colleges would have sounded Zoe and Caden's death knell, but nope. Zoe said they didn't even apply to the same colleges because they didn't want to be defined by their relationship. They each applied to schools within driving distance in the Northeast, so they could see each other often, yet focus on establishing their own lives and academic pursuits. Talk about mature. I spoke on the phone with Kellyanne Bate, Zoe's first-year roommate at Brown. Kellyanne was walking between buildings on campus when we talked, so you'll hear some background chatter and wind in the audio. Sorry about that.
I'll post a transcript of this part of the episode online with the show notes for reference.
I'd say Zoe was gone one, maybe two weekends a month our first year, and Caden was here on campus about the same. They'd stay in this little B&B nearby. She was always really respectful of the fact that we shared a room. More than I can say for some people at Brown. I'm sure it was a transition, being in college and figuring out how that factored into their relationship, but they made it work. Zoe didn't seem to have a problem blending her relationship into her world here. They'd come to basketball games, eat with us at the Ratty. They probably saw each other 3 weekends a month, all in all, and they were always on the phone.
Hmm. And what about the fall semester of sophomore year?
I'm not totally sure. We weren't roommates anymore, so I didn't notice as much when Zoe was gone for the weekend. And, you know, Zoe and I were friendly, but we had our own groups. I saw Caden on campus a couple times last fall, for sure. But Zoe had a single. I bet they were holed up there a lot. She did this marine bio internship in California over the summer, so they were probably ready for some one-on-one time.
I also spoke on the phone with Tim Romer, a friend of Caden's at Yale.
Zoe? Yeah, she was around a lot our first year. A couple times a month, she made an effort to get to know me. All of Caden's friends, really. Other people's girlfriends from home didn't do that. I always liked Zoe. She could hang.
And this fall?
Nah, she wasn't around so much. Caden was really busy with the radio station, and he's been doing this research project with Professor Eaton. She's the chair of our African American Studies department. She usually only works with grad students, so it's kind of a big deal. I thought something might have happened, but I didn't want to ask. But then Zoe was with Caden at the Gospel Choir's winter concert right before break, and everything seemed fine. That was the last time I saw her.
It's my hunch, and this is only a hunch, that the key to unlocking what happened to Zoe Spanos lies in the events of that fall semester of sophomore year, the fall leading up to her disappearance. What was Zoe doing when she wasn't visiting Caden at Yale? Were they really just busy, or did Zoe meet new people that fall? Who were they? And how much did Caden know? Did the police even bother to ask? I doubt they did, and here's why. According to their own accounts, Caden Talbot and his mother were not in Heron Mills on the night of December 31st last year. The Talbots regularly spend Christmas week in the city with close family friends on the Upper West Side. Astrid did not wish to be recorded for this episode, but she did confirm that the Talbots were among the first people Mr. Spanos called on the morning of January 1st, when Zoe had not come home. According to Astrid, the Talbots had initially planned to return from the city in time for Zoe and Caden to spend New Year's Eve together. Zoe had been excited about their plans, which included attending Jacob Trainer's house party together. But at the last minute, the Talbots' trip home was delayed to the following day. Mrs. Talbot did not feel up to traveling that afternoon. So when Mr. Spanos called on the morning of January 1st, the Talbots were allegedly still in the city. Caden told Mr. Spanos that he had last heard from Zoe around 2 o'clock that afternoon, when the two had exchanged text messages about the change in plans. Caden and Mrs. Talbot returned to Windermere the afternoon of January 1st and spoke with police on the afternoon of the 2nd. The final text message exchange between Caden and Zoe was entered into evidence and is on record with the Heron Mills PD. It's here where I believe local police first dropped the ball in this case. Because Caden and Meredith Talbot were allegedly not in Heron Mills the night that Zoe vanished, they were not further interviewed by police. Were their alibis investigated? Confirmed? This remains unclear. Here's what I do know. Meredith was able to account for Caden's whereabouts up until 10:30 on the night Zoe disappeared. Then she went to bed. He was next seen at 6:30 a.m. when Doreen Wynn Carey, the family friend with whom they were staying, passed by the couch where he was sleeping on her way to the bathroom. Not only were their alibis restricted to this closed triangle of Doreen, Meredith, and Caden, but the 8 hours between 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. remain unaccounted for. I guess their story was good enough for the Heron Mills PD, though. To reiterate, I am not suggesting that Caden or his mother perpetrated violence against Zoe or were even directly involved in her disappearance. But I do not believe we can so easily rule them out. And at the very least, I believe that Caden knows information about that fall, about that night, about Zoe's life, that could lead us to find her. Caden, if you're listening, I'd love to talk to you, on or off the record. Please get in touch.
Chapter 9. Then, June, Heron Mills, New York. I am not at my best during dinner, but fortunately, neither is anyone else. We're half finished by the time Tom arrives to the table, dressed down and looking a bit flustered. He gives Amelia a kiss, murmuring something about a rough Friday at the office and getting stuck late in a meeting. She's clearly pissed. I take a big gulp of water and keep my mouth shut. He's been back since at least 5, but it's none of my business what he's been up to. My mind is somewhere else entirely, with Caden and Zoe. As we eat, I stumble over every question Tom asks about my first week at Clovelly Cottage. Mary's garlic-roasted chicken sticks in my throat. My lips are thick and sluggish. They struggle to form the words that could prove I'm all right, perfectly normal, fine, just fine. Fortunately, Paisley comes to my rescue, happy to recount our various excursions around the town in elaborate, lively detail. She mercifully leaves out the bit about me leaving the oven on and then abandoning her to Mary's watch for much longer than a few minutes this evening. The air around me buzzes with the truth. Caden is Zoe's. Caden loves Zoe. And now Zoe is gone, leaving Caden to his lonely summer in Heron Mills. Laying low and avoiding the watchful eyes of the village that rooted me out at once, caring for a mother who is unwell in some way that has led to Windermere's steep decline. Caden avoiding the town's pity. Maybe their accusations, too. My thoughts stay stubbornly lodged at Windermere all day Saturday while Amelia tasks each of us with an array of housekeeping jobs and errands in preparation for the small garden party the Bellamys will host in honor of Tom's 38th birthday on Sunday. In the afternoon, I drop Paisley off at the Coopers for the girls' pool date, then drive Amelia's car to the florist on Main Street to pick up a missing bouquet from the Bellamy's order. Back at Clovelly Cottage, I peek at the guest list. There are 103 affirmative RSVPs. Caden and Meredith Talbot's names are included among a small list of guests who have not responded to the invitation. I breathe a small sigh of relief. As I cart lawn furniture from the shed to the yard behind the pool, I perfect my inward cringe. What must Caden have thought of me? Poking around Windermere twice in 3 days, my uncanny resemblance to his missing girlfriend. My failed attempt at a neighborly gift, which he probably saw as a thinly veiled attempt to gain admission to Windermere, and wasn't that exactly what it had been? I'd wanted an excuse to see him, to be invited inside, to insert myself into his life. I hadn't known what I was doing, but I'd done it all the same. No wonder he'd shoved the cookies back into my hands once he'd gotten a clear look at my face. Under an hour into Sunday's party, I'm at a complete loss. I'm technically on nanny duty as usual, but Paisley is running around with Rachel and a small gaggle of their friends, and they don't need much in the way of supervision. I almost wish they did. It would give me a reason to stay far away from the bar setup beside the hot tub. The pool deck is swarming with well-heeled guests